Thank you. Good morning. I'm going to ask our marshal to call court to order.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Werke, Judge Flory, Judge Bryan, the Honorable Renee Werke presiding.
Good morning again, and thank you for appearing at the Court of Appeals for oral argument on our Zoom platform today. Hopefully this will not continue indefinitely, but we do appreciate your cooperation. Rules of appellate court remain in place despite the fact you are appearing by Zoom, although you do not have to stand if you would prefer to sit. Please pay attention to the time frame. Our marshal has a clock posted in my upper left-hand corner. Each of you has 15 minutes for presentation of your case in chief, and 5 minutes is reserved for appellate counsel for rebuttal argument if you choose to utilize that. A reminder also to mute yourself when you're not speaking, and please introduce yourself and state which party you're speaking on behalf of before making your remarks. I'm going to ask our marshal to now call the first case for presentation.
Calling case number A210232 in the matter of the medical license of Michael D. Castro.
Mr. Offutt, when you're ready to proceed, please go ahead.
Thank you, Judge Werke and members of the panel. May it please the court, good morning. I'm David Offutt of the law firm of Winthrop & Weinstein on behalf of Dr. Michael Castro. This case is a classic example of agency overreach, where the Board of Medical Practice imposed its will rather than its reasoned judgment, where a disciplined Dr. Castro, a physician with an otherwise impeccable record, based on nothing more than assumptions and hearsay. The board's pursuit of discipline in this case was unjust, it was unprecedented and unyielding, and must be reversed. It was unjust because the board punished Dr. Castro for failure to cooperate with an investigation based on allegations that he never responded to letters that the board contends it mailed to him. But the board never called a single witness who actually conducted the investigation, wrote or sent any of the alleged letters, or was involved in the mailing process whatsoever.
You know, the thing is, failure to cooperate has kind of a harsh ring because it sounds as if he was obstructing something to do with the two complaints, but you know, that isn't what we're looking at here. What we're looking at here is failure to respond to mailed notices. And two complaints were filed. He goes through the litany of not responding to those, yet when there is another matter that is of his interest, he does receive the communication. How do you dispute the record evidence in terms of what was sent and no response coming from your client?
Well, respectfully, Judge Werke, there is no record evidence, no competent record evidence to support actual receipt of the mail or constructive notice under the Nofsted test. And every Minnesota authority, every board, every agency, including the Board of Medical Practice, including the Minnesota Supreme Court and its regulation of lawyers, has required actual knowledge and or willful avoidance. This is the first time that this board or any other board or agency has interpreted failure to cooperate to include instances in which the person does not have actual knowledge, and instead what is vaguely referred to as benign neglect. So in other words, a licensee can fail to cooperate with an investigation without having any knowledge of the investigation. And this defies common sense. It also belies the plain and ordinary meaning of failure and to cooperate. And it belies the structure of the Medical Practices Act, the harsh penalties under the Act, and the Act's policy of only punishing injurious conduct, not benign neglect, which was what the board held or concluded in this case. And again, it belies the board's own past discipline practice and the interpretations and disciplines of all the other regulators in the state, including the Supreme Court. And in its brief, the board offered no response to virtually every one of these points. And in this case, respectfully, there's no deference owed whatsoever.
So, Mr. Offutt, I'm trying to formulate what would have been sufficient in order to proceed on the merits of the complaint. So did you in fact intend there to be testimony of an individual saying, yes, I posted this in the mail, I mailed it to the last known address of the doctor and so on? Is that what your argument is?
Yes, Judge Werke, the argument is that actual knowledge was required either by testimony of the licensee, of somebody at the office, or the investigators at the Board of Medical Practice and the Complaint Review Unit. Under the court's precedent, as well as the board's precedent, and every other regulatory agency's precedent, again, actual knowledge is required. And even if it was only constructive knowledge which was required under the Nofsted test in this court's rule, the board, in its decision, must have had evidence, competent evidence, of habit or custom with respect to mailing from the sender's office, coupled with some evidence showing compliance with that custom in the particular instance. And the committee did not call a single witness with any personal knowledge of any aspect of the case. They only
Mr. Offit, if I can interrupt you, what are we to make of the fact finder attaching significance to two telephone calls the agency received from someone identifying themselves as Dr. Castro's assistant, who had knowledge of the contents of these confidential letters and requested an extension of time to respond? That would seem to be an indication of actual notice that the fact finder relied on.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. With respect to that testimony, the record is clear. Number one, there was no personal knowledge of anybody conducting the investigation who fielded the calls. There was no testimony from any investigator who purportedly, again, documented anything in the record. Also, the board's decision does not rely on these records because of the fact that it was based on objections on the record when Ms. Van Etta Olson, who had no personal knowledge of the investigation or this case or the calls, was specifically excluded from the record in that instance. And so that's a great point, Your Honor. Looking at what the board has tried to do in its brief, it has tried to justify after the fact, demonstrating again yet another danger signal by pointing to these calls that weren't even in the record or appropriately in the record.
Let me ask you about another piece of record evidence then. The board goes on to determine that the United States Postal Service, their tracking system demonstrated that the materials were delivered to the last known address. What was lacking in that regard?
Same thing under the Nofsted test. Again, there was no testimony of the particular custom or practice in this instance, number one. Number two, as we demonstrated on the record, first of all, that is hearsay evidence that was admitted. And that goes to not only the reliability of the evidence, but also the sufficiency of the evidence in this case. The board's own evidentiary standard prohibits a finding based solely on hearsay and discipline in hearsay. That's also the Baranek case and also the McLeese case. But in this instance, there was no evidence. It was certainly not signed for by anybody at Summit Orthopedics. And so we're left finding, where was this left? Where did any of this evidence go in this, where did this mail go in this instance? There are seven, as the record evidence demonstrates, actual evidence testified by those of personal knowledge, Dr. Castro and Ms. Broad. There are seven separate offices in that same building. There's no evidence it was even left at the same suite. Turning to, again, back to the substantial evidence test in this case. We've touched on it a little bit as it relates to the notice that was required. But in this case, again, I touched on it briefly, the board's decision is not supported by any competent evidence. It relies entirely, if you review the sole complaint review unit, the committee's sole witness, rested entirely on assumptions, what may be typical, or what she believed, but none of it was what she knew. And again, even assuming that the board could have met its burden through constructive notice and mailing, it failed to comply, as I said, with the Nofsted rule. Again, the sole witness called by the committee was Ms. Van Etta Olson, who testified about the general procedures at the board, but was not personally involved in any aspect of the investigation and did not have any personal knowledge of any of the facts at issue. And the board implicitly concedes as much and doesn't even respond that she testified as to the mailing procedures, which is required at the complaint review unit, central mailing, or the attorney general's office. The committee did not call a single witness, again, involved in the investigations, or who allegedly touched any of these mailings. Again, the committee failed to establish both prongs of the Nofsted test, and it realized that it had to meet that burden at the beginning of the evidentiary hearing, and that's at the transcripts of page 346, but did not do so. Judge Flory, in the Enbridge case, you concluded that the commission acted contrary to substantial evidence because the record reflects that neither the FEIS nor the responses to comments addressed the very important impact of the Lake Superior watershed. And again, the same thing holds true in this particular case. Ms. Vanetta Olson's testimony was limited to assumptions. She assumed the letters were mailed out, but assumptions are not evidence. And the board rested on assumptions about its own process, which is a serious hazard, as demonstrated by the board rubber stamping the committee's process, the complaint review unit's process in this case, and did not meet its burden as required by this court's precedent. It's now attempting to improperly shift the burden to Dr. Castro that the board did not mail these letters to him. It's inappropriate for the board to ask this court to do the same thing. And this lack of evidence is remarkable. This is not more than some evidence or any evidence. This is a complete failure of proof. The board's own evidentiary rule requires it, that its hearsay is insufficient to support a finding and discipline. That's Minnesota Rule 5615.0900. And again, Minnesota's also established the same rule.
If I can interrupt, counsel, I guess I'd like you to address for me what authority the board might have to make inferences based on evidence and what we do in reviewing those, because it seems like you're asking for evidence of every single step along the line, right? And if there's some evidence that supports the conclusion and the fact finder is required to make an inference, it seems that that's something we review on a routine basis and have some deference for.
So respectfully, thank you, Judge Bryan. Respectfully, with respect to the standard, there's no question that the committee had the burden of proving the case by the preponderance of the evidence. And certainly the judge is allowed to admit some hearsay, but with one caveat, one exception. The judge can only admit hearsay if it's the type of evidence on which reasonable, prudent person...
I'm going to interrupt because I'm not asking about hearsay. Okay. Or reliability. What I'm asking about is if there's a fact that has been proven and there's an inferential step that must be made, is that proper for the fact finder? And what's our standard of review when looking at an inference based on evidence?
Yes. And again, I apologize if I didn't address that squarely, Your Honor. The judge did not make any findings based on competent evidence. Okay, so there is no deference owed. The standard of review as it relates to substantial evidence is whether there is some evidence in the record, competent evidence, evidence that is meets that preponderance of the evidence standard. And so when there is incompetent evidence upon which the administrative law judge drew inferences, there is absolutely no obligation for this court to defer to that or the board's final decision. With respect to the public interest, I'd like to touch on that as well. As the panel knows quite well, every agency and board decision must be supported and in the public interest. And the board fails to explain why discipline is appropriate in this case, where there's no public interest served by the discipline. The underlying patient complaints were dismissed, and they were dismissed immediately upon submission of the expert reports, which again, had Dr. Castro known about these complaints, he would have responded to them immediately as well. No patients were harmed by any conduct, and there was no other violation of law. Thus, although the board argues that it imposed the lowest form of punishment, it punished Dr. Castro for no reason at all. This, respectfully, is per se arbitrary and capricious, and violates basic notions of fair play and substantial justice. The board argues in its brief that the public interest is served somehow by discipline because it needs to punish, to remediate, or to deter. The board has failed to articulate how punishment serves any public purpose in this case, other than a general statement that it must protect the public. This is not like typical board actions either, where remediation is appropriate, where there was knowing conduct or a failure to comply, for example, with the standard of care that could be furthered by way of some other education, training, or self-reflection. And certainly deterrence, which was another grounds upon which the board attempted to rely or attempts to rely on its justification now, there's no way to deter conduct that takes place without someone's knowledge. He had no idea that he was not receiving mail, nor would any other similarly situated licensee. So how can this deter him or any other similarly situated licensee? I'd like to turn back now quickly to the arbitrary and capricious standard. And actually, I will reserve the remaining additional 30 seconds. Thank you for my rebuttal. Your Honor, and pass it over to Mr. Schubert. Thank you.
And as indicated, Relator does have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We'll turn to you, Mr. Schubert, speaking on behalf of the board.
Thank you. Daniel Schubert, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice. Relator Dr. Castro appeals the board's order disciplining his license to practice medicine and surgery in the state of Minnesota. He has an affirmative duty to respond to the board's investigation of his conduct. The board's order is fairly based on a preponderance of the evidence, and the board imposed the lightest form of discipline it has available. The board's order should be affirmed. Before I go into some of the reasons why, briefly about the board, it's required to investigate jurisdictional complaints alleging or implying a violation of a statute of rule the board is empowered to enforce. It's required to investigate jurisdictional complaints. For context, some of the terms you may see in the documents here, the board's complaint review committee, that is made up of board members who review complaints, investigate on behalf of the board. The board's complaint review committee is supported by a department within the board, staffed by board employees called the complaint review unit. The complaint review unit manager is Catherine Vanetta Olson. The board members on the complaint review committee involved in this case were not allowed to deliberate or vote in any proceedings before the board pertaining to this case when the board was making its final decision. All physicians in Minnesota licensed by the board are responsible for maintaining their address on file with the board and responding to their regulator if they are the subject of an investigation, as Relator was in this case. Relator does not address the standard.
I think that the thrust of the argument, at least the beginning of the argument, is that, gee, how do we know he even got notice that you wanted him to respond? It's a multi-office building. The U.S. Postal Tracking Service may not have been correct, and you had testimony from somebody in the office that perhaps misstated, or we don't have direct evidence. I mean, affidavits of service are not required in this. So what do you need to demonstrate that this person received notice? Is that Your Honor, their burden?
Your Honor, there was an affidavit of service to Relator, and the board's final order and the administrative law judge.
My point is this: how do you prove effectively? How do you demonstrate that they received the notice?
There were fact findings made and credibility determinations. It's, quote, it strains credulity to believe that licensee received board's mail related to his licensure, but not the investigation, despite it being directed to the same address and mailed via the same process. It's highly implausible that none of this mail, sent by three different processes and two separate entities, made its way to licensee. Also, the board's order and the administrative law judge found that the board's committee presented reliable evidence of mailing to Relator. So the record shows that there is evidence of mailings to Relator supported by certified mail, supported by an affidavit of service, and testimony explaining the customary practices and how they were applied in this particular instance by the complaint review unit. There are multiple mailings sent by the board's committee or on its behalf for the board's investigation. The relator's arguments about the sufficiency of the evidence, cooperation.
Mr. Schubert, let me jump in because I as you're listing off the evidence that you believe is in the record, right? We have a very wide gap between your perception of the evidence in the record and relator's counsel's perception of that evidence and characterization of that evidence. So let me pause for a minute. Would you agree at least that there's more that could have been presented or more that could have been done to show notice?
Your Honor, yes, there could have been more, but more was not required. The finders of fact in this case determined that it was a sufficient showing on the preponderance of the evidence burden of proof to show that mailings did occur and that the entry of a proportional form of discipline was appropriate. There is no requirement of actual knowledge in the Medical Practice Act. Those arguments miss the mark. The bottom line is here, Your Honor, that the Medical Practice Act requires that all licensees put their address on file with the board to receive board communications and notices. And it specifically defines cooperation to include responding fully and promptly to any question raised by or on behalf of the board relating to the subject of the investigation and providing copies of patient records. The Medical Practice Act is drafted in such a way so grounds you failure to cooperate specifically and cross-references to 147.131, which is that quote I just provided about what cooperation includes. There is nothing about proof of actual knowledge here. The board made credibility determinations. The administrative law judge made credibility determinations. They found that it strains credulity to believe that these mailings did not reach relator and that there was reliable to believe that the mailings were sent to relator. The board exercise, the board's order should be affirmed because, again, respondent has met its, or relator has not met its burden to show that board's order was arbitrary and capricious. The board exercised its judgment, not its will. The violation of the Medical Practice Act gives the board authority to take disciplinary action, and this is the lowest form of discipline, a reprimand, in the spectrum of all the forms of disciplinary action available to the board under section 147.141. This is at the very bottom of the list. The board has authority to impose one or more forms of disciplinary action for a single violation. Here, it imposed a single form of disciplinary action. It is the lightest form of discipline. The court can look at Padilla versus Minnesota State Board of Medical Examiners for the deterrence language. A reprimand in this case serves that deterrence value very well because it does not do anything
Schubert,
to restrict.
Yeah. Mr. Schubert, I am going to jump in again, and I appreciate the argument here, but as you're trying to articulate the connection to the public, right, the interest here, I'm wondering what you think the interest is of the requirement of cooperation in the first place. What interest does that serve?
Your Honor, there are two quotes in the board's order and the administrative law judge's report I'd like to share with you to highlight and answer that question. Quote, to read a requirement of proof of actual knowledge into the Medical Practice Act's investigatory provisions would greatly impair the board's ability to carry out the act's purpose. Another quote, the Medical Practice Act does not require an affirmative act of refusal to conclude that a licensee has not cooperated with an investigation. So to address your question, Your Honor, the board's interest is to do its job. It is required to, by law, to investigate all jurisdictional complaints alleging a violation. It has a population of licensees who have licenses issued by the board who have an affirmative duty to first maintain their address on file with the board to receive notices, and second, to cooperate with the board's investigation, responding fully and promptly to any questions raised by the board or on its behalf when that individual is the subject of the investigation.
You know, Mr. Schubert, it seems to me like the crux of this case is all about notice. If there was notice of the kind required, then, and competent evidence of that, then there doesn't seem to be much of an argument for a lack of cooperation. So it really strikes me that this case really turns on whether notice of the kind required under the law was received here. And that really, I think, is the most important part of the case, at least from my perspective. I asked Mr. Schubert or Mr. Offed about this reference in the record about two phone calls received from someone identifying as his assistant with familiarity of the contents of these confidential communications, who requested an extension on his behalf to respond. I understood Mr. Offed's response to be that really wasn't competent record evidence. What's your position on that?
Thank you for asking that question, Your Honor. Relator offered those exhibits in question, and they were received by the court. They are part of the record, those phone call records.
So
let me jump in. Oh, go ahead, Jeff. Sorry, I wasn't sure if you were going to follow up or not. I was just.
Well, my only follow up was, so your position then, that would be an issue of weight to be given by the fact finder as opposed to whether it was legally admissible and part of the record. Is that your position here?
Yes, Your Honor. They went to weight rather than admissibility. They were received into the record. The finder of fact did rely on all of the information in the record informing their decision. There's not a specific reference to those phone call records. However, we do see credibility determinations that were made by the finder of fact as to the whether or not mailings were sent to Relator, and the fact that it strains credulity and it's highly implausible to believe that none of this correspondence reached Relator under the facts that were presented for the hearing and for the board's consideration.
All right, thank you. Sorry for interrupting, Judge Bryan.
I was essentially going to ask the same question. Judge Flory had asked you about the characterization that it's not competent, Mr. Schubert, and your first level response was, well, it's admitted. That's not really addressing the question about how it's competent. Just because it's admitted doesn't make it competent. So I think I was going to follow up along the same lines and ask you to give us the I would say most competent, I guess, the most reliable, the strongest evidence that was admitted that shows notice in your view.
Well, Your Honor, the strongest evidence to show notice is the board's order finding that the factors were met, that the evidence was sufficient for discipline. To answer your question further, Your Honor, the affidavit of service attached to the notice of conference served to Relator in November 2018, advising him of his affirmative duty to cooperate, and that he is required to meet with the Complaint Review Committee to discuss the matter as part of their investigation and attempt to review the matter. That is an extremely strong piece of evidence, Your Honor. Relator did not respond to that or submit a written response as required. Further, the notice of conference and all correspondence was sent to Relator's same address that he would agree it was the correct address he placed on file with the board.
Credibility thing that you raise in your brief, where he responded to the licensing matters that pertain to him, but not to the investigatory matters.
Yes, Your Honor, that is the context of the quote I have shared about a strange credulity. That's part of the evidence that was presented and part of the record. And given all of that, the finder of fact did ultimately say that this is more likely than not what occurred. This is what the finder of fact believes happened, and discipline is appropriate. And the definition of cooperation in grounds U that Relator focuses on here, again, it specifically cites to what cooperation means in section 147.131, and that includes responding to the board's investigation and answering their questions fully and promptly. Relator did not do that at all during the investigation. And a couple points I'd like to hit for the court There are there is no proof of actual injury that is required by the Medical Practice Act. Looking at several other provisions, which are not strictly at issue in this case, but unprofessional conduct and standards of practice, those do not require any proof of actual injury. Hearsay is admissible in the Office of Administrative Hearings under their rules of evidence. The judge evaluated that properly. The board did not rubber stamp the administrative law judge's decision. Looking at the hearing transcript from the board's hearing, you'll see robust questioning from board members asking tough questions, evaluating the facts, making reflective findings, and really taking their time to work through the record. It demonstrates an extreme attention to detail and that they were thinking through this and the necessity of the board's ability to conduct an investigation when it's using the address on file that a licensee has given to the board for that purpose. The statute specifically provided that the licensee is required to put their address on file. It doesn't go beyond that. So what this case is for the court's consideration is sending multiple notices, at least five, supported by certified mail, affidavit of service, sufficient for the board to conclude that that individual, for whatever reason, did not cooperate with the investigation. And here, as was noted earlier, there are the telephone calls by Judge Flory mentioning that. Those records were received into the record for the hearing, and the finder of fact evaluated all of that. That concludes my argument, unless the court has any further questions.
It appears not, Mr. Schubert. Back to you, Mr. Offit.
Thank you, Judge Werke and members of the panel. I'd like to address a couple of points that I don't believe Mr. Schubert touched on or addressed squarely. Number one, again, the Nofsted test for constructive notice was not met in this case. Again, there was no evidence of habit or custom for the complaint review unit submitted as to mailing or as to central mailing or the Attorney General's office. And there was no firsthand witness testimony of actual mailing in compliance with that habit or custom. With respect to the suggestion that there were credibility determinations, respectfully, this case is not about credibility, it's about competency.
Let me jump in there, Mr. Offit, because I think when you say competent, I think you might think it means something different than how I'm hearing it.
Okay.
How is saying something is not competent evidence isn't that just another way of asking us to reweigh the evidence, that you're challenging the weight given by the fact finder?
Respectfully, Judge Bryan, no, what I'm saying is simply that the board's entire case cannot rely on hearsay evidence. Again, the administrative law judge is required to follow the rules of evidence at OAH. Respectfully, she did not. All of the evidence that was admitted in this case, including allowing Ms. Vanetta Olson, the committee's sole witness, to testify, was predicated, if you look back at our motion in limine, predicated on the fact that she had substantial personal knowledge about what she was going to be testifying about the investigation of Dr. Castro, the mailings of the letters, and there was none. I respectfully submit that this is not the type of information or evidence upon which reasonable parties or reasonable prudent persons are accustomed to rely on in their personal affairs. And I certainly would not want to be disciplined based on nothing more than hearsay evidence. Again, further, as I touched on earlier, the board's own rule 5615.0900, says that hearsay may be used for purposes of supplementing or explaining any direct evidence, but shall not be sufficient in it itself to support a finding unless it would be admissible otherwise. And that's exactly what we had here in this case. It's solely based on inadmissible hearsay evidence.
What was the declaration? So hearsay is when somebody makes a declaration outside the courtroom, and then the witness is talking about that declaration, the substance of that statement. As I look at this, you have the witness, Ms. Vanetta Olson, who talks about her personal knowledge of practices, right? And so your argument is that she assumes that in this case, the notice followed those practices. That doesn't sound like an out-of-court statement offered for the truth of the matter. What is the hearsay problem? Break it down if you can for me. What's the out-of-court statement that Ms. Van Etta Olson then relays in court?
She's trying to relay in court as it relates to these alleged calls from the assistants that, number one, the board changes policy purportedly because of problems in this case, because it violated the Government Data Practices Act. Again, we don't have any information because no witness from the committee or the complaint review unit testified who had personal knowledge. And so she was relaying statements of purported calls that we don't even know who the parties were to these calls. Also, again, we challenge on foundation grounds all of the documentary evidence that was entered into the record. So those are the two primary reasons.
I understand the foundation objection. I get that. I just wasn't clear what the statement was that you thought this witness relayed. And I guess if you're tying it to the phone calls described, then I understand it. Thank you.
Absolutely. No, thank you. And thank you for clarifying. Again, with respect to, and you look at the board's decision, the board's decision did not rely on these alleged calls that took place where there was no knowledge or no personal or a firsthand testimony about it at all. This, again, is a classic danger signal. That, along with the board's reliance on the Gregory case in its response brief, which had no bearing whatsoever and was easily distinguishable, as we note in our brief. I see I'm wrapping up on time here. Dr. Castro would respectfully request that the panel reverse the Board of Medical Practices decision, and we thank you.
Thank you to both of you for appearing today. The matters were well briefed and the arguments enhanced our understanding of the matters. It will be taken under advisement with a decision issued in the statutory timeframe. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.